Good morning to everyone. We will begin with introductions from the court. I am Mike Heviken, and I am the Chief Justice. And now, by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman.
William Castle. Good morning.
Stephanie Stacy. Good morning.
Good morning. I am Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik. Good morning.
And John Freidenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Our first case today is State versus Dewey. Mr. List, good morning to you. Is there anyone here today on behalf of Mr. Dewey? I don't believe so. So, Mr. List, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. Your Honor, may it please the court, Nathan List, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. Dewey claimed to the district court erred by denying his motion for post-conviction relief. He signs 5 errors on appeal, which are all intertwined and revolve around his overarching post-conviction claim that the sentence imposed on his youth conviction is disproportionate and unconstitutional in violation of the Eighth Amendment. We maintain that his post-conviction motion was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing because it contains insufficient allegations and it's affirmatively refuted by the record. Just briefly, for purposes of this argument, I would briefly reiterate the two preliminary points set forth in our brief. Number one, to the extent this has been alleged as a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel or trial court error, that's procedurally barred, and the only claim properly before this court is this layered claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. And number two,
is this a different claim than excessive sentence?
It is, yes. I mean, there are some similarities and some overlap between an excessive sentence claim and an Eighth Amendment claim, but it is different. Our case law makes clear that with respect to an excessive sentence claim, we generally consider that in the cumulative or in the aggregate, whereas with respect to an Eighth Amendment claim and a disproportionate claim, we're looking solely at that claim and whether the sentence imposed on that claim is grossly disproportionate to that crime. So they are different. I think he's raised a different claim here than he did on direct appeal, if that's what you're getting at with your question. The district court found that this claim, among other reasons, it denied his claim is procedurally barred. I'm not sure that that's necessarily accurate because the claim on direct appeal was excessive sentence, whereas, as I read his post-conviction motion, it's sort of a hybrid of alleging it's excessive, but also is clearly, as I read it, alleging that it violates the Eighth Amendment. So I don't think it's procedurally barred in that regard, but is only properly before this court as a layered claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim, meaning he would have needed to prevail if it had been raised on direct appeal. With that said, as set forth in our brief, first and foremost, we submit that his allegations are insufficient because his allegations do not set forth or do not establish that the sentence imposed on his youth conviction violated the Eighth Amendment.
Can I back up ever so slightly? Let me see if I understand your argument. You're saying that the Eighth Amendment challenge can only be raised in the context of ineffective counsel for not having challenged the sentences on that basis, and it cannot be raised in the post-conviction, although it's styled a constitutional error by the court rather than ineffective counsel. In other words, the court made this mistake, not the lawyer made this mistake.
Right. Well, that would be procedurally barred since it wasn't raised on direct appeal. I mean, I think it's a constitutional claim, so it fits within the rubric of post-conviction, but to the extent it's either alleged as trial court error or ineffective assistance of trial counsel, that was not raised on direct appeal and could have been. So it's
because
procedurally
barred. All the facts necessary were known at that time.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. As far as the allegations in his post-conviction motion, he merely alleges that the sentence of 45 to 50 years on his youth conviction is substantially greater than the sentence of 19 to 20 years imposed on his manslaughter conviction, which he alleges is disproportionate and logically inconsistent. But our case law has made clear that an Eighth Amendment analysis does not involve a comparison of sentences in their cumulative or aggregate effect. It looks only at whether the individual sentence imposed is grossly disproportionate to the crime in question. Dewey's post-conviction motion contains no allegation to this fact. He doesn't explain why the sentence imposed on his youth conviction is grossly disproportionate or allegedly grossly disproportionate to the sentence in question or the crime in question. And relatedly,
Mr. Dewey, he doesn't seem to be arguing that the sentence on the youth conviction is disproportionate to the crime. He seems to be arguing that the sentence is disproportionate to the sentence he received for the manslaughter conviction. Is that how you understand his argument?
Yes, and that's precisely my point. Perhaps I'm not articulating it well enough, but that's why I think his allegations are insufficient, because he's not really even pleading a valid claim. In order for him to plead a valid claim, it would need to be that the sentence received on the use conviction is disproportionate to that crime, and that's not what he's alleging. He's alleging, as you said, that it's disproportionate to the sentence he received on the manslaughter offense. So he, from the start, he's not really even alleging a valid claim, and that's our basis for submitting that he hasn't raised sufficient allegations in his post-conviction motion.
Were you able to identify any cases where someone has raised a claim like this? I mean, I understand your argument that it doesn't really fit, but have other courts encountered this type of argument under the Eighth Amendment?
Not that I've seen. No, I haven't. I mean, they could be out there. I suspect there is something out there, but no, not to my knowledge, Your Honor. Alternatively, if this court finds that the allegations are sufficient, we maintain that the claims are refuted by the record because there's not a reasonable probability that Dewey would have prevailed if this claim had been raised on direct appeal. Dewey did raise an excessive sentence claim on his direct appeal, which the Court of Appeals rejected, finding that the district court did not abuse its discretion.
Is it possible that counsel couldn't have been ineffective because this is a concept that's never been raised before, apparently, by anyone?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the event that there would actually be something here, I don't want to be overly dismissive. In my assessment, there clearly isn't, given that he hasn't made sufficient allegations, and here his sentence clearly is not disproportionate to the crime of shooting and killing someone. But in the event that there were something here and their potential legal merit, I think there would be something to that it's a novel issue.
We have written, have we not, that you're not ineffective for failing to raise a novel issue.
Right. That's where I was going with that. To the extent that this would be an issue of first impression and potentially have merit, if it's novel, counsel would not be ineffective for not raising a novel issue, which this court has explained on several occasions. Just briefly again, though, as far as direct appeal, he did raise an excessive sentence claim that was rejected, after which he filed a PFR and this court denied it. We see no reason to believe that the outcome would have been any different if he had also or instead alleged that his sentence violated the Eighth Amendment, especially when this court has made clear that an Eighth Amendment analysis respects legislative determinations of statutory sentencing limits, and regardless of severity, a sentence of imprisonment which is within the statutory limits ordinarily is not cruel and unusual punishment in the constitutional sense. So even if he has raised sufficient allegations here, we would maintain that he cannot show prejudice and that the claims are affirmatively refuted by the record.
You have articulated in brief and at argument today several reasons why the district court's judgment should be affirmed. Is there a particular order of operation that we should follow in which of those grounds we address first, or is it just purely discretionary, easiest way to skin the cat?
It's all de novo, whether we're looking at what the sufficiency of allegations, whether it's procedurally barred or affirmatively refuted by the record. So it's certainly at your discretion to take any of those and go any direction you see, please, or that you would please. I guess in my own mind, I always start with whether the allegations are sufficient, because that, to me, that's just the logical starting point. If we don't get off the starting blocks, then why go any further? And in my assessment, the allegations are not sufficient here. So I guess in my assessment of the case, that's where it should start and end. The analysis should start and end. But
can you articulate again why you think the allegations aren't sufficient?
Yeah. It went toward Justice Papik's question of first of all, what is a valid allegation of a crime being disproportionate? It would have to be that the sentence imposed is disproportionate to that crime in question. That's not even what he's alleged. Really, the entire thrust of his allegations in his post-conviction motion is that the sentence he got on his use conviction is disproportionate to the sentence he got on his manslaughter conviction. But our case law is clear that that's not how we evaluate Eighth Amendment claims. We don't do a comparative analysis of one sentence versus another. It's just the sentence to the crime in question, and he hasn't alleged that. So we would submit that on that basis, his allegations are sufficient, legally insufficient. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next case of the day is Brown versus State of Nebraska.